mean so much to them that they become emotionally overcome. And there are times when you read the Bible and your emotions get the best of you. And there are times, like we just saw, when emotions just kind of burst through. I appreciate that song so much. It's a good song. Good song. Well, I call your attention this morning to Zechariah. Zechariah. If you held your place last week, you know where we're at today. Okay? Now, we're down to one more. Next week will be Malachi. If you missed any of the prophets, the other 12, all of these are on our website, and you can go to our resource page or media page, I forget what it's called, but you can go to that page, and all of the messages called the other 12 are there, all 12 of the prophets, and the 12th one will be not next Sunday, I think I said, but the Sunday after that. Next Sunday is Mother's Day. And so Malachi is not a mom, so we won't be preaching on him for 2 weeks. Okay. When I think of Zechariah, I want you to remember that he's the prophet of hope. Now, some of the prophets that we have looked at over the last 3 months have been messages that were preached by these men that were sometimes hard. I think of like the prophet Obadiah. Obadiah gave a hard message to the nation of Edom. In other words, there would be no repentance for them. Judgment was coming. But Zechariah is different. Zechariah is both prophet, but he's also a priest. The first part of Zechariah, the first 8 chapters, probably were written, as a matter of fact, we know when they were written because it's identified. It's identified as 520 BC. It's so precise in the dating that we know that it was 2 months after the prophet we preached on last week, which was Haggai. So what this means is that Zechariah, who was a young man at the beginning of his book, was a contemporary with the prophet Haggai. What we know about Haggai is that he preached 4 months. But what we know about Zechariah is he probably preached 40 years. But the beginning was very close to the previous prophet. Now, the book easily divides into 2 sections. There are 14 chapters in this book. Now, we're not going to cover 14 chapters today. We're barely going to cover chapter 1, if that. But in chapter 9 through 12, we don't really know when this was written. It could have been written as late as 40 years after 520, which would have made it around 480 BC. And so, we just know that it was written by Zechariah. Now, liberals, modernists, they would say it may have been written by 2 different men. But there's not a conservative scholar out there that believes that. The way that the book divides does not change the fact that one man wrote both. They try to make the same accusation about Isaiah. They say that Isaiah is divided into 2 and that he didn't write both of them. The only problem with that is when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, they found one scroll that had all of Isaiah on it. And so it was written all at one time. And so any of those criticisms are certainly baseless. And so he began preaching with Haggai. He also came back as a young man with the remnant. You say, now what is the remnant? I wasn't here last week. Well, Cyrus, who was the first Persian king that we were introduced to, A year after they conquered Babylon, he issued a decree that all the Jews could go back home. As a matter of fact, he gave them material to go back and build the temple. And so you have now in 536, they are headed back that way. And so the remnant were 50,000 people that had been in Babylon, people like Daniel, people like the three Hebrew children, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and also guys like Zechariah. Well, we never hear that Daniel went back to Jerusalem. We never hear that the three Hebrew children went back, but we do know that Zechariah went back. And Haggai began to preach because the people had waited for 14 years in kind of a holding pattern. They had worked for two straight years and they laid the foundation. And then because of some opposition, they began to become apathetic toward the things of God. And so you have Haggai and he spurs them to begin the work. But then you have Zechariah and he pushes them and encourages them and cajoles them. And 4 years later, the temple is complete. Now, I want you to look with me at chapter 2. I'm not going to preach out of chapter 2, but I want you to see one thing in verse 12. And the Lord shall inherit Judah, his portion, in the Holy Land. I've been telling people that this fall, I'm going to be taking some folks to the Holy Land. We're going to go to Israel. And we hear the term the Holy Land, it's bandied about all over religious broadcasting and in religious publications. The Holy Land, the Holy Land. Many years ago, down in Orlando, there was a Holy Land project. All right? There's a place in LaGrange that Brother Darrell is checking out for me. I've heard about it from some preachers back at the Preachers Fellowship that we had here. And they tell me, they said, this place is great. And I'm thinking about maybe trying to get a group of our senior folks and maybe load up the big bus and go down to LaGrange and have a day-long trip. And they say that it's the closest thing you'll have to Israel without going to the nation itself. But it's all called the Holy Land. Everything's the Holy Land, the Holy Land. Do you know this is the only phrase or only time that phrase is used in the Bible? It's the only time. It's usually called Israel, it's usually called Judah, it's usually called Zion, Jerusalem, all of those terms, the whole house of Israel. But the Holy Land right here in Zechariah is the only time that this is used. Well, when you read through this book, you will find visions. You'll find messages and you'll find burdens. Some people translate the word burden as an oracle. But most people like to keep the word burden because of the weight of it. The fact that it's something that you have to carry until times get better. And so, as we look at our prophet this morning, I want us to make sure that we have hope. Now, I want us to begin with verse number 1, and I want you to see three names. Because this is it's the whole theme for me of this book. Because names have meanings. And if you look at the words, what you'll find is you'll find that the word Zechariah is used to identify the person that's doing the writing. The word Zechariah means God remembers. Now remember that. All right? God remembers, remember that. All right? Now, it also says he is the son of Berechiah. That means God blesses. So his daddy's name was God blesses. His name is God remembers. His daddy's name is God blesses. But then there's another name, Idu. And that means at the appointed time. So keep that in mind. God remembers and God blesses at the appointed time. Sometimes we want God to remember and God to bless on our timetable. But it's God's timetable that we've got to pay attention to. Because sometimes God doesn't want to give you a blessing at that particular time, maybe because you don't need it as far as your growth. But I want you to remember that God remembers, God blesses, but it's at the appointed time. And so that'll be a theme that I may mention a couple of times during the message today. Now, concerning the visions that if you read it, there's a difference of opinion about how many visions they are in this book. Some people think that there are seven, which I think. There's some people think that there are eight, and I've heard people say there are as many as 10. And I think what they do is I think they sometimes take some of them that have two things together and they separate them and call them separate visions. But we're not going to take but two of those today. I'll give you all seven of them. We have horses, we've got horns, we've got a measuring line, we've got Joshua, who is the high priest, and he is being reclothed. We've got a golden candlestick and two olive trees. We've got a scroll and ephah and women. And then we've got four chariots. And so those are the seven visions that Zechariah has in his book. Now, it's interesting to me because all of these visions happened the same night. Now, you talk about having some dreams. He's got at least seven of these things, and it all happens one evening. Now, there are times when, you know, you will have a dream, and you'll shake yourself awake, and it's not a good dream. It's a bad dream. And you'll get up and you'll go walk around, you'll get you a glass of water. You might even sit up and read a little bit or turn on the television, you know, and find out how many knives that you can buy for $19.95. All right? And you'll sit there for a little bit and then you'll say, all right, I'm tired now, I'm going to go back to bed. And maybe you'll dream something totally different. But it's very seldom that we have seven visions or seven dreams in one night. But Zechariah did. And so I'm going to take two of those this morning, and I want us to look at these two from two different perspectives. The first thing that I want us to do, and all of this is going to come out of chapter 1. We don't have time to deal with all 14 chapters. But let me just say this, that from chapter 9 through chapter 14, there is a lot of prophecy that's going to take place beyond us. Now, many times when we're reading the prophets, and I've mentioned this in the last two or three months on a couple of three different occasions I know, often when a prophet would give his prophecies, there would be a near fulfillment, but then it would be a picture of a far-reaching fulfillment. And this is what we have with Zechariah. In chapter 1 through chapter 8, basically we have things that are going to be happening in the near future or things that are happening in the near past, and he's going to combine all of them as one continuous story. But then you'll get over into the later chapters, and many of those things I believe are going to be happening toward the end of the tribulation period. Things are going to be happening during the millennial. One of the things that I love to preach on is prophecy. And one of the verses that I've often used comes out, I think it's chapter 14, where it talks about all nations are going to gather against Jerusalem to battle. And all of a sudden, when they are about to pounce on the city of God, Jesus comes in Revelation 19 and wipes the whole bunch out. And so we're not going to get into all of them, so we're going to mainly hang out in chapter 1 today just to try to give you a little primer and maybe tease you a little bit to spur you on to read some of the chapters yourself and to do some in-depth study yourself, right? And so we're going to look at only two of the visions, but we're going to look at it from two different perspectives. The first thing that I want you to see is confusing times for these people. Confusing times. What I mean by that is this. The times in which they lived, they were a vassal state for Persia. What I mean by that is they really did not have any way to self-determine as a nation. Sure, Cyrus had given them the permission to go back, and now Darius is on the throne. But they know that they are still under the thumb, so to speak, of the Persians. And so they're trying to decide. 16 years ago, we came back. We've been working for 2 years, and then because of the political pressure, because of the neighbors that were around us, and they began to threaten us, and then we began to hear that Darius is mad with us, they began to slow the work down, and after 2 years of progress, getting the foundations laid, all of a sudden, for 14 years, nothing. And then old Haggai comes along. And then 2 months later, Zechariah comes along. And he begins to preach to them. I want you to look with me at the vision of the horses. Let's look at verse number 8. And I saw by night, and behold, a man riding upon a red horse. Now often whenever you read these visions and you see the symbolism that's offered in these visions, you can just almost get a really good focus on the message that's being delivered. So you've got a red horse. That would be a horse that would be maybe covered with blood, maybe red because of the battles. And so you can almost visualize a warring type person riding this horse. And he stood among the myrtle trees. Now myrtle trees grew in the lowlands. And so you've got this rider up on a red horse that will be identified here in a moment. And they were in the bottom, the lowlands, and behind him there were red horses, speckled in white. Now, I don't know that people really know what this would represent, much like the red horse is, represented probably by war and battle. But some people think because these horses were not solid in color, that it probably represents maybe justice and mercy. That could very well be. I would not get dogmatic on that. Then said I, O my Lord, what are these? In other words, he asked a question. You know it's not bad to ask questions of the Lord. One of the things I'll close with in just a little while is that it's okay to ask. And when he said, what are these? And the angel that talked with me, remember that. What you've got is you've got angels. There's three distinctions in our passage. Number one, you've got the angel that talked with me. There's one angel that seems to be back and forth in this vision that Zechariah is having. He's asking and the angel's answering. So there's one of these angels that's talking to him. There's also a group of angels that are riding on these speckled horses. So there's a group of them. We don't really see them talking. We only see what they're doing. And then there's a third one that we're going to get to in a moment. And so the angel that talked with me said, I will show thee what these be. And the man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are they whom the Lord hath sent to walk to and fro through the earth. So in other words, you've got these angels that are on these horses, and they're just going to and fro throughout the earth, and they're observing. They're seeing what's happening. And they answered, this is the third angel, the angel of the Lord that stood among the myrtle trees. I want you to remember something. The angel of the Lord is different from the angel that talked with me. The angel of the Lord is different than the angels that were riding the speckled horses. The angel of the Lord is used many times in the Old Testament. You find the angel of the Lord in Genesis. You find the angel of the Lord in Judges. You find the angel of the Lord in Joshua. You find the angel of the Lord in Daniel. You say, well, who is that angel? It's none other than Jesus himself. In theological terms, there are two words that would describe this. They're big words, and that's all it is a big word. It's a Christophany, which means that it's an appearance of Jesus in the Old Testament, or a theophany, which is an appearance of God in the Old Testament. And so when somebody throws those two words out, that's a Christophany, and they're trying to impress you, just go, just an appearance of Jesus in the Old Testament. And you've got Jesus before his incarnation. And by the way, you do know that Jesus did not start in Bethlehem, right? Jesus has been around forever. He had no beginning. Now, he was not known as Jesus until he was born in Bethlehem. He was simply the second person of the Godhead. And if you go all the way back to Genesis, what you'll find is you'll find the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost right there in the book of Genesis. What does the Bible say about God when he created, or the Godhead when they created man? It says, let us make man in our image. You find the Trinity in Genesis chapter 1. And so whenever somebody says, well, Jesus was born in Bethlehem, yeah, he was incarnated. That's when he took upon flesh. But he's been around as long as the Father's been around and the Spirit's been around. And so when some cult comes along and says, Jesus was a created being, just say, that's some Oscar Mayer theology. That's 100% baloney. All right? And so you've got the vision of the horses, and these horsemen are going to and fro throughout the earth. And look with me and we'll see what they observed in verse 11. We've walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest. In other words, everything has been conquered. After Cyrus defeated the Babylonians, and then Darius took over, there were about 19 different kings and countries that thought, you know, Darius is probably not as tough as Cyrus was. And so 19 different rebellions began to pop up, and Darius crushed every one of them. No matter the country, he crushed it. And everybody else said, okay. And there was peace. And what did they do? They told the Jews, they said, you go home, but you'll be a vassal. Sure, you can go back, but Babylon had already sent a bunch of people in there to mongrelize the people, and the Samaritans came from it. And so you've got the vision of the horses. But also you've got the vision of the horns. Look with me at verse 18. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, behold, four horns. And whenever you say, well, what horn are we talking about? Think about the horn on a rhinoceros. All right? I mean, you're thinking about something that is powerful and you don't want to be hit with it. All right? And so you've got four horns. And so I just asked the angel that talked with me, what be these? What are these four horns? And he answered, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. So who are these folks? Well, who scattered Judah? The Babylonians. Who scattered Israel? The Assyrians. But who conquered the Assyrians? The Babylonians. Who conquered Jerusalem? The Babylonians. And so you've got one horn that has conquered all of these, but now you've got three more horns that are coming, and they're going to conquer that first horn. If you read the book of Daniel, you'll find that there have been four world empires that we would call world empires. The Babylonians were first. They were greater than even the Assyrians. And so Babylon was number one. Persia was number two. Greece with Alexander the Great was number three. And then the Romans. The Romans. And so it does not matter when you're looking at Zechariah whether he's talking about what happened with the Babylonians or now in their current state, the Persians, or what he would see in the future, the Greeks, or what he would see even beyond that, the Romans. No matter which horn, Israel was still being subjected to them, and they were punished, they were persecuted, they were kept down. Why? Because these Gentile powers had the power to do it. There's an old adage that I hear from time to time in politics when people are trying to abuse their power. Power corrupts. And absolute power absolutely corrupts. If you doubt that, you just look at people, and whenever they get a little power and it goes to their head, you have very few people that can control their egos when they begin to get stroked. That's one of the reasons why I admire George Washington so much. Do you know, after the American Revolution, people came to him and they said, "We will help make you king of this new country if you would like it." And he said, "No, we're going to be a government of the people. We're not going to have a monarch." And he said, "I don't want to hear any more talk of this." And he turned down the opportunity to become a king, much like we had just defeated, that lived in England. And so you've got the horses and you've got the horns, and the times are confusing. I mean, you've got these horns, and I mean, they are just down, 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 beating the people of God down. But the second thing that I want you to see about the horses and horns is this. I want you to see some comforting words. Look with me at, let's look at verse number 12. Well, let's start at 13. And the Lord answered the angel that talked with me. Isn't that the third time we've read that? The angel that talked with me. And what did he talk with me about? He gave me good words and comfortable words. The word comfortable means comforting. All right? Oh, he gave me good words. I don't know about you, but I like to hear a good word from the Lord. I like to hear that. I like to know that when I need it, I got a Bible close by. I like to know that when days of trouble are there, that I can take my Bible out and I can get some real comfort. You say, has it always been that way in saint times, where there's Old Testament saints or New Testament saints? Look with me at the first part of chapter 1. The Lord said, "I've been displeased with your fathers." He said, "You turn unto me and I'll turn to you, but be not as your fathers." You know, one of the things that many folks do is they say, "You know, I want to be just like my daddy." Well, that's a good thing if your daddy's a good guy. if your daddy's as sorry as he can be, that's not a good thing to want to be like your daddy. Well, what had these folks done? He said, they rebelled, they sinned, they committed idolatry. When you think about their fathers, that's why Israel up in the north got conquered by Assyria. They just, every time they found a new tree on a mountainside somewhere, let's put an altar under it. Let's not just worship Jehovah, let's worship Balaam, which is a plural of Baal. Let's just worship all of these gods. Let's be syncretistic here. Let's just synchronize everything. You know, let's worship Jehovah, you know, and Allah. Let's put them both together. And God said no. And the Assyrians came in 722. And then 130 or 50 years later, the Babylonians in three different waves came in, because Judah had done the exact same thing their brothers in the north had done. And these fathers, what did they do? They got, some of them got killed and some of them were drug off into captivity. Don't be like your fathers, he says. Then he said, where are your daddy at? Where's your daddy at? Where are your father at? Where's your fathers at? I'll tell you where they're at. They're dead. They've died. He said, where's the prophets at? They're dead. Your fathers killed them. You think about the prophets that these guys rejected. They rejected Hosea. I mean, Hosea said, look, you've been adulterers. Matter of fact, to prove it, I married a woman that was going to be a prostitute. What about Joel? The day of the Lord's coming. What about Isaiah? They took him and stuffed him in a log and sawed him in half. What about Jeremiah? The Babylonians are coming. Shut up, we don't want to hear you. Don't tell me what the Babylonians are going to do. We're God's people. And Jeremiah saying, they're coming. They took him and put him in a dry well. He preached 4 decades and had 0 converts. They despised the prophets, and now the ones they despise, they're gone. But if you look at verse 6, oh, God says, but my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants, the prophets, did they not take hold of your fathers? In other words, my word came true. And I got news for you, the word of God's going to still come true. When we preach the word of God, if it's the word of God, you can take it to the bank. And so, we've got some comforting words. And so, why did God say they're going to be comforting? Well, if you look with me at verse 14, God said this, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy. All right? In other words, I love them and I love them greatly. I have great zeal. You could use zeal for the word jealousy there if you really wanted to. They carry the same connotation. And he said in verse 15, I am very sore. I'm angry. I'm displeased with the heathen that are at ease. Oh, you remember that confusing time whenever the people were saying, we don't understand it. I mean, we're still under the thumb of Persia. Everything's peaceful. I thought we were going to be set up here as a nation. God says, I'm angry at them because they helped forward the affliction. In other words, they didn't just conquer my people. They humiliated, abused, and did more than they needed to do to hurt my people for that chastisement. And because they did that, God said, I'll fight their battle. And we're not going to get to it, but in chapter 2, in the next vision about the measuring line, God says this, you don't even need a wall around Jerusalem, I'll be your wall. You don't have to worry about fighting, I'll take care of business if it needs to be taken care of. And so it's great comforting words knowing that ease that these horsemen had seen, God's going to say, I'll deal with that. But not only that, look with me at verse 20 in relation to the horns. In verse 20 it says, and the Lord showed me four carpenters. The Hebrew word for carpenter has the idea of a craftsman or a smith. All right? It's not just somebody that is crafted in woodwork, but would also be someone crafted in iron. We may call them a blacksmith, or we may call them artisan. And what are these four carpenters? What are these four artisans going to do? Well, that's a question that he asked. These are the horns which have scattered Judah. In other words, these are the ones that came in and basically they ransacked my people, so that no man did lift up his head. But these carpenters, these smiths, these artisans, they are come to fray them. The word fray, it means terrify. God is going to have some carpenter come in. And this carpenter, of course, is a symbol of something that's powerful. And he's going to come in and he is going to terrify these four horns. And if you look at secular history from our standpoint, looking backward, you have Babylon, the first horn. And what took place in Babylon? The great Persian Empire came in and terrified Babylon and took it over in a night. Read Daniel. And the Persians clicked along for a while, and then all of a sudden, because of the abuse and because of what they had been putting on the people of God, God raises up Alexander the Great, and he comes in and he conquers the Persians. And then Alexander, he dies, and the kingdom is divided into four sections, and you've got four generals, and each one of them take a piece of it. And they click along and they persecute the people of God, and they try to basically mongrelize the Jews. And then all of a sudden the mighty Romans come in. And Greece has now been terrified because of the iron boot of Rome. And then Rome is taken out by, well, so far, nobody. Rome has never been conquered. Now, we don't know Rome as it used to be, but there was never anybody that came in and conquered Rome. It fell from inside. It fell because of the corruption that was within itself. And there are some people think that America may fall that way. But there's coming a time, according to the prophet Daniel, that there's going to be a stone that comes without hands. And it's going to take and it's going to crush that revived Roman Empire. And who is that stone? It's the Lord Jesus Christ. And so, there's comforting words. Why? But because all of those horns that have been hurting God's people are going to be cut off. They're going to be the saw that cuts the powerful down to size. They're going to be the hammer that breaks it off. And there's coming a time when Jesus comes back, and again, you could begin reading in Zechariah 9 through 14, and you can begin to see this. You begin to pick out this, pick out that, and you'll see that there's coming a King of Kings and a Lord of Lords one day, and his name is Jesus. Sweet, sweet Jesus. But when he comes then, he's not coming as a lamb, he's coming as a lion. He's coming as a lion. Well, what are our takeaways today? Three of them. Number one, Don't be surprised when your experience looks like ancient Israel's. It just seems like that nothing you can do makes those in authority over you happy, and your life seems to be every day one misery. I mean, nothing you can do, and you just get hammered at work. Maybe you get hammered at school. I mean, you just have all kind of trouble. Well, ancient Israel went through that same thing. Did not Solomon say in Ecclesiastes that there's nothing new under the sun? Human nature has been human nature since the time of Adam when he fell. And so you're going to have experiences that are very similar, probably not to the same degree. There's not anybody in here that's going to be threatened with your life in the morning, not unless it's a criminal that does it. But you don't have a government right now that stands over you and says, well, I'll take 30 of you out there and cut your head off. We don't have that. And I pray to God that we never do have that. But I know this, I know that there are times when we just don't understand why we're having to go through some of the things we go through. Second thing I want you to see is this. Don't be fooled by the appearance that somebody may be at ease. All of us have had this thought, you know, I don't understand it. I know some of the godliest people, and they seem to suffer. Financially, they're always up against it. And then you've got some guy that owns a liquor store, and that joker just has everything his little heart could want. And that's as old. That thought's as old as the Old Testament. Hold your place in Zechariah, and I want you to flip over to the book of Psalms. Go to Psalm 73. I want you to see what old Asaph had happen. All right? He says this, truly God is good to Israel, even to such as are of a clean heart. In other words, he starts off with a compliment to the Lord. But then he begins to kind of get into the whole mindset that he's going through because he's been watching some people. And he's having a hard time that these people that are godless are being blessed. Listen to what he says. But as for me, my feet were almost gone. My steps had well nigh or almost slipped. Why? For I was envious at the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. I mean, you look at that guy that just runs around on his wife. You look at that guy that cheats on his taxes. You look at that guy that hoodoos everybody that comes his way. And it just seems like that everything just happens good for him. He said, when I saw the prosperity of the wicked, he said, I'm kind of envious at that. There are no bands in their death. They don't seem to be having any problem when they die. They just like, yeah, we'll die and get it over with, no big deal. Their strength is firm. In other words, they don't have really a lot of health issues. They're not in trouble as other men. They're not even plagued like other men. Their pride compasseth them as a chain. In other words, they got such a cocky attitude. It's as they're walking around with a big gold chain. They got their bling on. I don't know if that's still popular to say bling or not, but 20 years ago, I think they had bling, all right? Violence covereth them as a garment. In other words, their whole life is one just trying to hurt somebody. And they just wear it proudly. Their eyes stand out with fatness. In other words, they eat until their heart's content. Oh, there's no leanness in their body. All right? They have more than their heart could wish. They're corrupt. They speak wicked. Concerning oppression, they speak loftily. They set their mouth against the heavens. In other words, they even curse against God. And their tongue walketh through the earth. In other words, the way they run their mouth, it just goes all over the place. They're ungodly in verse 12. Verse 16, he said, when I thought to know this, it was too painful for me. I thought about all these wicked men that I see, and it just bothered me. Oh, but then, verse 17, he said, I was bothered until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then understood I their end. In other words, this is the best they're ever going to have it, because what awaits them is horrible. And so he said, when I went to the sanctuary, finally I saw it. And in verse 25, he's happy again. He said, whom have I in heaven but thee? There is none on the earth that I desire besides thee. My flesh and my heart faileth, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Somebody wrote a song about that, which is a great song. And it comes right out of Psalm 73, verses 25 and 26. So don't be fooled by the apparent ease of the wicked. And the last thing is this: when you don't understand and you can't see it, you can't see God's plan with what He's doing in your life, you can still ask God about it. Did He not ask multiple times? And the angel would answer him. We can ask God, and sometimes He will answer us, and He'll give us what we want. And then sometimes He'll say no. And then sometime there's no answer, which means wait. And so when you don't get the answer, yes, that you want, and He hasn't said no and He's saying wait, then you trust Him. Our God can be trusted. Don't ever forget that. I believe our God can be trusted. And we ought to learn that often. We ought to learn it so often that it comes just natural for us. We don't understand, I trust Him. He doesn't answer, I trust Him. Lord, I'm 40 and you haven't let me have this happen. You trust Him. Lord, I'm 30 and I haven't let this happen. Trust Him. You say, have you ever had a situation like that? Absolutely. At this church. See, I had my life mapped out when I was a college kid. My plan was this: I'm going to go to school, I'm going to get an education, I'm going to start working at a church with a pastor that I really respect and really grow to love. And when I'm 30, then I'll go pastor a church. And then I'll stay there until Jesus comes or I die. And I'll only be at two churches my whole life during my ministry. That was the goal. I mean, it was mapped out from the time I was 21 years old. That's what I'm doing. I got to start working at this church before I ever got out of college. I thought, I'm ahead of the game. Then I graduated, and I was still being able to work here at this church. But then I started knocking on 30. You know, Six Flags was getting old. All-night activities, they're getting old. By the way, is it this Friday night that Awana, or last Friday? Last Friday. God bless those Awana workers that can do that. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm ready. I got a phone. All somebody's got to do is call. And over the next few years, I'd either go preach for somebody and I just didn't want to go, or they would say, we don't want you to come. And I thought, well, okay. When 40 hits, that'll be good. And after all, I mean, you're still young at 40 in the ministry. Same thing. Then 50. Then I'm thinking, maybe God's not going to do it. And during those 20 years in there, I'd tell my wife, I think God's forgotten us. God doesn't know where we're at. And she'd say, you know, quit having a pity party. God bless supportive women. God knows where you're at. And then it got to the point, well, if I'm going to pastor here, you know, Brother Don, you know, he's not going to retire. You know, but I'm thinking, but that's his business. That's between him and the Lord. You know, I'm not, hey, if there's one thing that I was going to be at this church, I was going to be loyal. I'd had no use for anybody that wasn't loyal to the man they worked for. I mean, I'd just soon be dead and in my grave to be disloyal. And so when people would say, Brother Don about to retire, I got no idea. I don't talk to him about that. And so, you know what? The church voted me in to be the co-pastor about 4 years ago. But still, everybody still knew who Moses was. It was Brother Don. Well, the Lord's allowed me now to basically come upon my first year of being the senior pastor at this church. And God didn't let me live out the plan that I really thought he was going to let me do. But can I tell you something? I like the plan that God's given me. Because I trust God. I like the fact that God knows a lot more than I do. And so I'm happy as a clam. I have people ask me every week, you like it? Yeah, I love it. It's great. God's good. I want God to do something here that's bigger than even what I dream. I want God to do something bigger than what you dream. And he'll do that. These folks were confused. Oh, but then the prophet of God came along and they began to get comfort. When we don't understand, talk to God, but always trust him. Let's stand.